Indigenous ecologist and MacArthur genius Robin Wall Kimmerer has a brand new book, The Service Berry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World, which comes out tomorrow. Robin never set out to be the celebrity status author that she has become. In 2013, a small press quietly published Braiding Sweetgrass to modest success and almost no publicity. It was only 7 years later that the book mysteriously took off and hit the New York Times bestseller list, where it has remained for 219 weeks and counting. Braiding Sweetgrass has gone on to sell over 2 million copies. The new book, The Service Berry, expands upon the wildly popular message of Braiding Sweetgrass that by incorporating wisdom from indigenous teachings and the natural world into our daily lives, we can combat not only ecological destruction, but also the epidemic of purposelessness and isolation affecting all of us in our digitally focused, self-interested world. Again, the name of the book is The Service Berry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. It's a great pleasure to welcome Robin Wall Kimmerer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At what point did you start to actively say, okay, it's I have more to say, I would like to put this together and really move on from what I laid down in the first book?
The Service Berry has a really interesting origin story, I think, in that it was published originally as an essay in Emergence magazine. But then my editor, Chris Richards, really catalyzed it as a slim volume when he said, you know, I think everybody should read these ideas, and I want to bring this out as a small book. And he invited me at that time to expand the essay if I wanted to. And with the passage of time and deeper consideration, I did want to. I wanted to dig more into this examination of our values and how they are manifest in economies. And, you know, ask the question, why do we tolerate an economy that destroys the natural world rather than upholds it? I don't have the answer to that, but I wanted to ask the question and invite readers to think along with me.
So the book comes out almost immediately after an election, and an election where many of the issues that you tangentially talk about are very much at the forefront. I can only guess. You certainly know your readership much better than I do, but I would think that this would be something that many people would flock to for some solace.
Yes, it will not surprise me, because what the book also suggests is that in this time when hyper-individualism, accumulation of wealth, income inequality, destruction of the natural world, all these things we might be mourning at this time, the book also suggests that if we look to the natural world, we might find some models to do things differently. So it invites readers to think about gift economies rather than only market economies and how we might create them around us.
Why do you believe that we don't naturally look to nature more often for solutions?
Well, you know, for the longest time in human history, land was regarded as our teacher, as the source of sure. information. So it's really only in the past few centuries that we have not looked to the natural world as models for how we humans ought to live. Because after all, we're part of the natural world too. So why shouldn't we be guided by the principles that organize all other living systems? And so I think, though, that with the imposition and development of cutthroat sorts of capitalism, it has really separated us from the living world and almost made us adversaries of the living world rather than allies. And that's what this kind of thinking opens the door to, is think about how could we be good partners for the land rather than destroying it.
Well, and just that idea of being allies, of how we get that to hold out our hand and allow someone to grasp it and say, okay, we're in this together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in this time of great division that we're all suffering from, when I try to think about where could we find common ground, the answer that I keep returning to is the ground, the land. It seems so simple, but all of us, every single person needs clean air. We all need water. We need biodiversity. And so it seems to me that that can be a place where we might find common ground in thinking about the land that we want to leave to our descendants.
You talk to many who are working on ecological economics. You also talk to indigenous people as well, and I would like to get to that in a moment. But in that field of ecological economics, what did you learn? What did you learn from them and the work that they're doing in that field?
Yeah, I was really excited to learn from my colleague, Dr. Valerie Louzaitis, who's a past president of the Society for Ecological Economics, that there are a lot of brilliant minds out there that are trying to think about how do we incorporate the limitations that are imposed on us by the living world by straight up laws of thermodynamics. How do we obey ecological laws and at the same time deliver goods and services, deliver well-being to all the citizens of the planet? And those citizens include not only human people, but the more than human people, the members of the of what we would refer to as biodiversity. And so there's a lot of really good thinkers working on these problems, which was gratifying to learn.
And as I mentioned, you did talk to indigenous tribes who operate real life gift economies. Give us a sense of those, of what those economies look like.
A gift economy is, by nature, a system of delivering what people need for well-being, where the currency is gift, where if I have abundance, I share it with my neighbor. And when my neighbor has abundance, they share it with me. And the currency is not only the thing, which might be shared, be it food or labor or whatever, but it creates bonds of relationship. It creates bonds of trust. Gift economies really only work in close-knit, trusting societies where people are known and held accountable for being a good neighbor and being part of a community. Unlike in a market economy, right? Market economies don't create relationship or community because
Right.
they're transactional. You pay your money, you're done. That's the end of the relationship. But gift economies create community. And that is something that money can't buy, right? We all want that sense of community, of belonging, of being respected and valued in our communities, especially in this time of kind of isolation and hyper individuality. So I think gift economies offer us an opportunity to create community alongside the market economy, which so dominates our lives.
It is one of the things I love about this book, just from holding it in my hand, is that you don't often see the word reciprocity on the title of a book. It's it's just a lovely thing and topic to include very, very upfront as to what the message is.
Yeah, it delights me to have that word in parlance these days in a way that it didn't used to be. You know, the other day I was driving down the highway and I saw a bumper sticker that said gratitude and reciprocity as a bumper sticker. So I thought, like, yes, we are moving along.
Robin Wall Kimmerer is our guest. The name of the new book is The Service Berry: Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. The book is out from Scribner, and Robin will be at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts on Wednesday. That's November 20th on Wednesday, in conversation in that event at Harvard Bookstore. And as you go out and you talk about the book, I think it would just seem to me that a lot of people are going, as I said before, are going to look to you and look to this book as for some sort of solace. Were you, how are you doing after the election?
I am.
Because I'm a mess.
That's a good. There we go.
I'll start there. I'm a mess. How are you doing?
I think because I have been called upon for solace from others, that act and needing to put together words of encouragement has helped me, but truthfully, I'm just grieving. I am grieving what I learned about our country. And at the same time, that grief, instead of it can lead us to despair, right? Against all the political pressures, the economic pressures that are stacked against us. But for me, I just want to say I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And trying to lead with love, lead with gratitude on behalf of justice for people and justice for the land. It's all we can do.
You talk about gratitude and you talk about community, which are so important. Empathy, I would add to that as well. How do we approach that, especially when we know, you said earlier, isolation, but also just polarization too. And I'm curious as to how we come to those, how we come to gratitude, a personal gratitude, and the gratitude of a community, and we work together of what is possible within our groups, our friends, that can then spread.
Yeah. Joe, I'm glad you asked that question because to me, one of the really important messages and practices in this time, is paying attention and carefully guarding our attention. There are, because it's a limited resource, isn't it? And there's so many forces out there that are competing for our attention and wanting to divert our attention. And so, to me, one of the best gifts that we can give each other is to pay attention to the gifts of the natural world and understand them as gifts. It's not our possessions. And when we pay attention, we can't help but fall in love with the world again. And we are in the place that we are today on the brink of climate catastrophe, in the age of sixth extinction, because we haven't loved the world enough. And so attention and the love and care that it generates is a really valuable pathway to gratitude. And when we have that sense of abundance and sufficiency in the living world, then we have plenty to share with others. And that helps us create community. But so much of it is reclaiming our attention from what corporate America wants us to pay attention to, from what political America might want us to pay attention to those things that really sustain us.
When it comes to sustaining ourselves and just trying to work through things, whether they be global or personal, and back to nature and back to the earth and back to the ground and what we can realize from that, what is a for you a beginning step, a starter kit, if you will, for people to start that process?
To start the process of finding our way back to that relationship.
To finding the way back to the relationship, I guess starting a relationship and understanding how it can be beneficial to us.
Yeah, I think it comes back to paying attention and to recognize the living world as a teacher of sorts. We started our conversation by talking about solace, right? The solace that we find in each other and the solace that we might find in the natural world. And that's all true. But I think we also find guidance. And in this particular moment, guidance that I'm finding from the natural world is, when I think about, I'm looking right now at these immense old maples outside my window. They've seen a lot of political change come and go. They've seen a lot of environmental change come and go. But what do they have to say about this in their centuries-old life? To me, they're saying, yep, things change all the time, but what our job is to build good soil. Like trees do. And what do I mean by building good soil? By creating the conditions for the flourishing of change. Building good soil so that we can have renewal of our values and our culture. And that's the invitation, I think, to folks is to say, how do we create good cultural soil where we can where the potentials for change can grow and flourish. And just looking at the way these old trees are handling all of that change and crisis, what they've done all along is build good soil for the future. And that's what I aim to do too.
It's so funny you say that because as I look out of my view, that I'm on the top of a mountain and I'm overlooking the Berkshires straight ahead, the Green Mountains to the slight left, and all the way to the left, the Adirondacks. And the valley is, I can't see the valley because of the smoke from wildfires that has made its way up from the Mid-Hudson Valley and outside of New York City. And it's just fascinating because you, as you say, that valley will always be there, but it's also today we can't see it. So you have to pay attention. This is what you were saying earlier. You have to pay attention, but then you also have to just assume that it will like will that it will take care of itself, but we have to help as well, right?
Oh, absolutely, right. That notion that we have to be participants in the well-being of land. And in many cases, things like wildfires in this extraordinarily dry year, indigenous science and land care used cultural burning, right, to care for land in the past so that we wouldn't have catastrophic wildfires. So some of what we have to pay attention to is ancestral knowledge and indigenous science of land care. But always the message in ancestral land care is that we human people have an important role to play in caring for the land. It isn't just letting nature do its thing, that we have to be good participants as well. And as you describe your view of that beautiful landscape, I think it's also really important to remember that while we pay attention to the beauty of the landscape, we also have to pay attention deeply to the wounds to that landscape. And the grief that we feel, the pain that we feel for the loss of our beautiful places has to be the catalyst that incites political action, that incites ecological restoration and cultural change. This is not a tension that leads us just to a passive kind of contentment, but a tension that leads us to reciprocal action.
I would like to leave the conversation with one, just a reading, a short bit from toward the end of the essay. There is no question that all living things experience some level of scarcity at various points and therefore have competition for limited resources like light or water or soil nitrogen will occur. But since competition reduces the carrying capacity for all concerned, natural selection favors those who can avoid competition. Oftentimes, this avoidance is achieved by shifting one's needs away from whatever is in short supply, as though evolution were suggesting if there's not enough of what you want, then want something else. The specialization to avoid scarcity has led to a dazzling array of biodiversity, each species avoiding competition by being different. Diversity in ways of being is an antidote. So, as we close, what can we learn from that?
I think that diversity notion calls to all of us to honor, protect life of all kinds of there is no other. There's only kinfolk, there's only relatives, and that we are beholden to one another as evolutionary, genetic, and ecological family.
The name of the new book is The Serviceberry: Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. The book is just out from Scribner by Robin Wall Kimmerer. Robin will be at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts on Wednesday, and you can find out more information by going to harvardbookstore.com. Harvardbookstore.com. Robin, what a great pleasure to speak to you. Congratulations on the new book, and thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Again, the name of the new book is The Serviceberry by Robin Wall Kimmerer. The book is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.